From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the new film, The Last King of Scotland, Forrest Whitaker plays the Ugandan dictator Idi Amin, who is considered responsible for the deaths of about 300,000 people. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Whitaker about getting into character and about his life. His other movies include The Color of Money, Bird, Ghost Dog, and Panic Room. This year on the FX cop series The Shield, he played an overzealous internal affairs detective. Also, we listened back to an interview with singer Freddie Fender. He died of lung cancer Saturday at the age of 69. He's best known for his 1975 hit, Before the Next Teardrop Falls. It's a great record. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring Philadelphia's Sound About Philly audio walking tours at soundaboutphilly.com. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Forrest Whitaker, has starred in such films as Panic Room, Ghost Dog, Smoke, The Crying Game, Bird, Platoon, and The Color of Money. He's a great actor, and this year he's proven that on television and in the movies. He was the guest star throughout the latest season of the FX cop series, The Shield, playing an overzealous internal affairs officer. This week, he'll guest star on ER. Now he's starring in the film The Last King of Scotland as Idi Amin, who was the dictator of Uganda in the 70s and is considered responsible for the deaths of about 300,000 people. The film is about Amin's rise to power and a young, naive Scottish doctor who's talked into working for Amin as his personal physician. The doctor is initially impressed by Amin, then watches him turn into a monster. In Entertainment Weekly, Whitaker's performance was described as mesmerizing, capturing the mercurial madness of Amin, charming one moment, homicidal the next. Here's an example of each side, starting with the charm. Early in the film, shortly after Amin has seized power in a coup, he makes a speech that wins over his audience.
And I want to promise you, this will be a government of action. Not at once. We will build new schools, new roads, and a new houses. I may wear the uniform of a general, but Queen Moyo Wangu in my heart. I am a simple man, like you. I know who you are and everything that you are. I am you.
Now for Amin's other side, the homicidal madness. Later in the film, Amin's convoy is attacked by men he assumes represent former President Milton Obote, who Amin overthrew. Amin speaks to the men before having them executed.
You work for him, Obote! Huh? That drunk, silly man! You want to kill me for that drunk, silly man? Huh? Uganda loves me because I am a loyal and I am a fair. I am your president.
Forrest Whitaker read a lot about Amin and watched a lot of footage before shooting The Last King of Scotland. I asked him which of Amin's actions he found most difficult to comprehend.
Once I started to do the research for him, for Idi Amin, the choices that he made started to come into clarity for me. I started to really understand him, actually. I mean, he was a soldier initially. I mean, he joined the army when he was very young, and he started at the bottom, and he was really embraced by the British Army. He was in the King's Army, and he was embraced by them and promoted by them for his battles against the Mau Maus and many other things. And he was one of the only soldiers. There was two soldiers that were chosen to go to Sandhurst to train, so they loved him. You know, then he trained with the Israelis in paratrooping. And so I started to just define, you know, the things about him that ended up motivating him to do that. And through this understanding, through them putting him into power, the British, I start to understand the paranoia that started to happen when he started to feel deserted, not just by the British and Israelis, but by all the countries around him, when he started to feel surrounded, because he was a soldier first and foremost.
Let's start with getting Idi Amin's style of speaking. Mm-hmm. What did you do to learn his speech patterns?
Well, I mean, before I left, when I first got the role, I started working on the accent. And then I started working on trying to understand as much Kiswahili as I could. And by studying the tapes of him and his interviews, it was a key for me into like trying to understand a little bit of, at least in my imagination, the way he was thinking. And I started to analyze just the way he emphasized certain things, not just in English, but I would listen to tapes of him speaking in many different sort of tribal languages or many different dialects, because he spoke like 11. And I would just try to absorb that, because I think that was a key for me to understand how to play him, was to trick myself in my mind to believe that Kiswahili, or the Kakwa language, was my first language, and that English was my second. And so in that way, it influenced how I approached dealing with certain people and the things I had to overcome, or Idi Amin had to overcome, in order to be able to communicate properly.
Can you give us an example of what you mean?
What I mean is, take for instance, I'm speaking to you. You know, I'm speaking to you now in English, and if I tell myself that I'm searching for words in my mind to express the thoughts that I have, it starts to change. Even now, just the demeanor and what it is I'm trying to say, and how I emphasize what I'm trying to say, because this language was a big deal to Idi Amin. I mean, in fact, he like made them start to teach the native languages in the schools. He started to return back to the tribal languages and dialects because he felt it was important for national pride. And in fact, when he went to the UN, he actually spoke in Kiswahili there and had it translated, which was very unusual, actually for an African ruler. You know, they would normally speak in English. And it was a big statement about how he felt he should be able to be represented and how he felt he should be respected.
Actors always say that they draw on part of themselves no matter what kind of character they're playing. So what part of you do you think you drew on to play Idi Amin?
That was a great thing about working on the characters, you know, because I did have to try to go inside and explore the darker sides of myself, you know, which helped me understand myself a little bit more, a little better. And at the same time also, Idi Amin was the kind of person who'd come into a room and just like swallow it, you know. And that was something I needed to like work on too, you know, to try to understand how to come in and own the space the way he did. And so I kept trying to search for those things inside of myself and the confidence that he was able to have, which, you know, I don't necessarily walk through life with that kind of clarity and confidence.
Yeah, confidence, right. He, the way you portray him, he sure had plenty of that.
Mm-hmm.
So were there physical attributes of him too, that you found in videos and news footage that you incorporated into your performance?
There's a lot of things, I mean, that helped key me in to try to find his spirit, I think. One was some of his gestures helped me, like, find a definitive way of kind of dealing with people when he would say his speeches, and some about the way he would move, his walk, you know, was with such a certain sense of certainty. Again, like the timbre of his voice, because it was he spoke lower than I do, in a lower register than I do, which gives you, when you speak that way, a stronger sense of center. So there was, and then of course there's a physical, I mean, we didn't do any prosthetics or anything like that to look like him, but we definitely, I was a darker, we darkened my skin, and because he's from the Sudanese part, he's on the north of Uganda. And then I got larger. I gained even more weight to play the character.
How did you feel about having to darken your skin to play the role?
I was playing a very specific person, and I think that people don't really know a lot about Idi Amin. They just have this like generalized concept of him. But one thing I think people know is that he's from sort of the Sudanese part, which is more of a blue-black undertone. And I think people do know that, and that it would feel false for people if that weren't the case.
My guest is Forrest Whitaker, and he's now starring as Idi Amin in The Last King of Scotland. In this year on the FX series, The Shield, you were like the guest star through the series.
I did like 13 episodes.
Yeah, and so there's a couple of more episodes left that you'll be appearing in when the Shield starts up again. And for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's a really terrific series about a kind of corrupt strike force in a police department just outside L.A. in a very tough neighborhood with a lot of gangs and drugs. And you play someone from a detective from Internal Affairs who's there to investigate this strike team. And I want you to describe your character of Lieutenant John Cavanaugh.
John Cavanaugh, he's Internal Affairs. He is someone who has a very clear definition of what he considers right and what he considers wrong. In this case, he follows the road of right as completely as he can. And he thinks that Vic Mackey and the people that work with him are corrupt and they need to be stopped, and that they're the worst thing that could possibly happen to a police officer who's meant to serve, who actually murders, cheats, steals. And so it's my job to get Mick Mackey off the street.
I really love your performance in The Shield, and there's something, you know, you're somebody who is extreme in your pursuit of what you think is right.
Mm.
And you will go to extremes in the same way that the corrupt cop, you know, Vic Mackey goes to extremes, except that you're doing it in the pursuit of justice, so it doesn't bother you at all that you're doing it.
Right.
And you really know, in this character really knows how to use his presence to intimidate people.
Mm.
And I guess if you could talk a little bit about finding that part in yourself as an actor so that you can intimidate people to tell you the things that they don't want to tell you.
I think that Cavanaugh is interesting because he really watches and understands human behavior. And so he tests people. I mean, I think one of the first things that happens is when I you see me testing Benito's character, Dave, with a pack of Juicy Fruit gum, and he doesn't take it. And I say, well, if you take it, then it's been an indication in a way that I could break you. And later you see me pretending to have children at the school and with Vic Mackey's wife, with Kathy. And
you're trying to get on her good side. And she has, you know, that she has a couple of kids and that they're developmentally disabled. So in order to, you want information from her. So in order to get on her good side, you pretend like you're a father, which you're not. And she has no idea that you're playing her.
Exactly. And I try to become friends with her, and I also do the gum test, and she takes the gum. And then ultimately later, she does crack, you know. So he's a student of human behavior, and he knows how to push and pull on people to get them to respond so he can get the information that he needs. And sometimes that's being a friend, actually.
Let's hear that scene in which you're trying to get on the good side of Vic Mackey's wife, actually his ex-wife, and Mackey is the head of the strike team, and you're pretending to be a father.
Gum?
Oh, no, thanks.
Come on, it's a fresh pack. There you go.
Sure, thanks.
That's your boy?
Yeah, and our daughter.
Two? Wow, that must be tough. And I'm struggling with this one autistic child. It's the challenges of single parenthood.
Yeah, doing it alone is hard.
You too?
Yeah.
Daddy's not in the picture.
He does what he can.
And my ex, she doesn't even acknowledge our child.
I'm sorry.
Sometimes I wonder why I even married her. Really. You ever feel like that?
I'll see you around.
Can I call you sometime? I'm sorry, it's just that they told me that I should try to get to know some of the other parents, and I'm out of my depth. I could talk to you, or I could talk to your husband. Either one, if, you know, whatever you...
Yeah, okay. Last name's Mackey. And you can call me about the kids or the school. My husband's not going to be much help.
Thanks.
That's Forrest Whitaker and Kathy Ryan in a scene from The Shield. Whitaker stars as Idi Amin in the new movie, The Last King of Scotland. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We do our best to bring you interviews with the most talented actors, directors, musicians, and writers working today, and give them a chance to reflect on their lives and their work. Your station is fundraising today, and your response will affect your station's ability to carry Fresh Air. You see, each station that carries our show has to pay a fee, and that fee goes toward our production budget. That's the system used by most of public radio's national programs. Anyways, your station needs to raise money from listeners to cover that fee, so I hope you'll pledge now. Thank you. My guest is Forrest Whitaker. He plays Idi Amin in the new film The Last King of Scotland. This season on the FX cop series The Shield, he plays an overzealous internal affairs investigator.
I want to contrast the characters that we've been talking about, your character on The Shield and your portrayal of Idi Amin, with a character that you played in a movie a few years ago directed by Jim Jarmusch called Ghost Dog. And in this movie, you're an assassin, but... You are obsessed with samurai warriors and with the code of the samurai warrior, and you are this philosophical, almost mystical presence in the movie, even though you're an assassin, and you're also a very quiet presence in the movie. So it's a completely different character. Let me just play a clip here. This is you from the beginning of the film reading out loud, you know, reading to yourself from the Book of the Samurai.
Meditation on inevitable death should be performed daily. Every day when one's body and mind are at peace, one should meditate upon being ripped apart by arrows, rifles, spears, and swords. Being carried away by surging waves, being thrown into the midst of a great fire, being struck by lightning, being shaken to death by a great earthquake, falling from 1,000-foot cliffs, dying of disease, or committing seppuku at the death of one's master. And every day, without fail, one should consider himself as dead. This is the substance of the way of the samurai.
Forrest Whitaker, is the book that you are reading from in this scene from Ghost Dog a real book?
Yeah, it's a book called The Hagakure, which is the way of the samurai, It has many teachings inside of it to help you understand how to approach life as a samurai. And I think it probably, many of the teachings inside the book are a way of approaching just life in general, just as like Sun Tzu's book, The Art of War, and many other books reflect sort of metaphors in life.
And I read that you studied martial arts. Where does that fit in for you?
I've been studying martial arts since I was a kid, since I was about 12 years old. I started studying Filipino Kali, which is like Philippine martial arts. It's a lot of weaponry. And then I started studying Kenpo. And then I guess recently I studied a lot of, that was with Danny Inosanto. And then I studied, Wing Chun, Muay Thai, boxing. Martial arts is one of the greatest teachers I've had as a person. I think even in my acting, the things that I learned from my early martial arts instructors is probably more informative to me and how I approach my work than even most of my acting classes.
Why is that?
Because it taught me how to understand how to approach a situation. It taught me to understand energy and the movement and transference of energy. It also taught me about going to try to get to a point, meaning even if it's a strike, and understanding the different angles and approaches that could be done and how the infinite possibilities that can occur in trying to get to your goal.
You know, and when you talk about a character having confidence in himself, like Idi Amin, did studying martial arts give you confidence in yourself physically and in your ability to go through difficult things with confidence?
I think that that it's helped me to grow as a person, and it's given me some sense of center. In the case of Idi Amin, my training was stepped up. My instructor, Joe Jackson, in Los Angeles, put me in an even deeper combat zone, because I pretty much practice combat arts. And so, but in this case, it really started to get really intense. And I learned things about myself, because he would say, as I'm going in and we're middle of sparring, he'd say, why do I feel your energy moving back? You know, your purpose, you need to go through me. You need to move through me. You know, and that's why when I hit you here or touch you here, you feel it so strongly, because I'm not hitting you. I've already walked past you, you know. And so you start to understand, again, like I'm talking about acting objective, and you also start to understand the issue of combat, because in that time when we were training, he was also saying to me, here in this zone that you seem to be afraid of, when we're so close and where everything hurts, this is a place that you have to be able to embrace. And it's from that understanding of that combat zone that I helped to form the character of Idi Amin.
Forrest Whitaker is now starring in the film The Last King of Scotland. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Forrest Whitaker talks about his first big acting break. He's now starring in The Last King of Scotland, about Idi Amin. Also, we listen back to an interview with singer Freddie Fender. He died Saturday at the age of 69. He's best known for his 1975 hit, Before the Next Teardrop Falls.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Sense of Paper, a novel of obsessions by Taylor Holden. From Casey Family Programs, a national foundation working to improve the lives of the 800,000 children who experience foster care every year at casey.org. And from the Annenberg Fund for Excellence in Communications and Education.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor Forrest Whitaker. His movies include The Color of Money, Platoon, Bird, The Crying Game, Smoke, Ghost Dog, and Panic Room. He stars as the Ugandan dictator Idi Amin in the new film The Last King of Scotland.
On TV, in the latest season of The Shield, he played an internal affairs investigator, and he begins a recurring role on ER this week.
Now, I know you grew up near Compton. Is that right?
Well, my parents moved to South Central Los Angeles when I was 6 weeks old, and I was raised there until I was 11, and then they moved to Carson, which is on the Carson-Compton line, until I was about 17 when I went off to college.
Okay, and I read that, you know, while growing up in or near South Central L.A., you actually went to school in a really wealthy neighborhood.
When I was in Carson, I was supposed to go to Compton High, and my parents didn't want me to go there because my mom was a public school teacher, and she knew the school at the time. She didn't think it was right for me, so they sent me to Palisades, which was about 2 hours away near the beach in Santa Monica.
2 hours? Did you commute?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you commuted 2 hours in each direction?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would go over to one side of town and then maybe catch the school bus from the other, from when I got to the other part of town.
Well, I mean, that just takes up so much of the day. Just commuting back and forth.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, we're talking about a person's whole future and their life, you know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, I mean, he's 1 hour more a day than somebody else might have to go or less or not. I don't know. But then I would study on the bus coming home. I played football and I would study the, you know, stuff on the way home. But then as a result of that, my view of the world like shifted. I became more aware. So the amount of understanding that happened from this choice that they did was like massive. So I'm sure I would still be doing something in a productive way if I had went to Compton High. Maybe I had a different set of choices. But I think people all kind of still live into their sort of destiny and their archetypal destiny in different ways. I mean, I would have been doing something different, but still experiencing the same things in a different way.
Now, when you went to high school, you were on the football team and you also sang. Were you studying singing?
In school, I mean, Palisades, I was in the magical choir, and so I was studying and you know, magical singing, and I did a couple of musicals. I didn't act in high school, but I sang in a couple of musicals in high school.
What do you still sing?
Not really. No, I mean, every once in a while in a movie, like in The Last King of Scotland, I sang, but it was in character, so it's different. It's not like me really singing, you know, as myself.
Did singing help you in acting?
I guess it did because I was doing an opera when I first got my first agent. So, you know, I mean, I was about to go to USC Conservatory, and I was doing this light opera called The Beggar's Opera, which is kind of a precursor to the Three Penny Opera. And an agent saw me and asked if they could represent me as an actor. And that was before I had taken an acting class. I had done one play. And then it also helped me go to school because I had a vocal scholarship at USC Music Conservatory. And so I couldn't have went to college unless I had scholarships. So I moved from a football scholarship to a music scholarship, and then finally to an acting scholarship to go to school.
Now, when you started to act, were there roles that you were offered that you didn't want to take because they were stereotypical?
Yeah, I mean, when I started to act, I wasn't sure, you know, what I wanted to do. I thought I was going to do theater, and so I was lucky because I was extremely idealistic, which I didn't really care much about money, you know. I didn't mind living on a couch or whatever, and the process of acting for me was me trying to become a better actor, decide whether this was something for me to do. It took me a long time into my career, almost 10 years, before I decided this is what I'm going to do. So if the part wasn't interesting for me or wasn't going to help me grow on a whole, I wouldn't do it because I didn't care. I didn't care if I was on TV. I didn't care if I was in the movies, and I didn't care about the money. I didn't mind doing like phone sales or whatever, you know, working whatever it meant to do. You know, but I started working really while I was in college, so it was different. You know.
So what was your foot in the door? What were the first little roles you got?
First little roles. I mean, I think I was like on like, you know, TV stuff like Cagney and Lacey, and I did like this big thing on Hill Street Blues once called Blues for Mr. Green, where I was like this kind of straight up gangster, you know, who got on the bus and shoots the bus driver because he wouldn't take my transfer, you know. But the thing about stereotypic roles, as you say, I mean, I don't mind playing roles that people say are stereotypic as long as I'm able to bring to them like a fullness, a clarity, where I'm able to express the motivations of a person, the characters, because I think that's the point of why I went into acting in the first place, was to find a human connection between myself and others and between my characters. And so those characters, like these figures that people think are dark and stuff, or they think are horrible, many times were people that I knew in my neighborhood and stuff like that. So I beg to differ sometimes on the way people perceive them and the reasons why they made the choices that they did. So it's important for me to sometimes play those characters.
Your big breakthrough, I think, was in The Color of Money, in which you played a pool hustler who out-hustles Paul Newman. What was your audition with Scorsese like for that? I'm assuming Scorsese was there for the audition.
Actually, the first time I auditioned for it, they just put me on tape. And I didn't get the job. They hired someone else. And then I got a call later saying that they were letting this person go. And would I be willing to fly myself, to pay for myself to fly to Chicago and audition for Martin Scorsese? And I was like, oh, wow, it's Martin Scorsese. So I paid for the ticket and I flew. Then I found out that the reason he had been fired was because he couldn't play pool well enough. And luckily, because of my obsessiveness, as soon as they told me about the audition, I had 2 weeks, and all I did was play pool for, like, I don't know, 12, 14 hours a day. So by the time I got there, I met with Scorsese. The first thing he said before I even got to read the lines for him was, you know, I want to see you play pool. And so I went, and I was playing the nine-ball champion. And luckily for me, he was trying to convince him that he should use a little eight-ball in the movie, which, like, so we got to play eight-ball, which was like, oh, this is easy. This is like a gift from God, you know, because there was so many possibilities of what I could shoot. And so I was just cocky about it. And it's like, you know, I'd been playing it so well. So that was after that, shortly after that, because I was like, you know, playing so well and like being so arrogant about it. They gave me the job.
Were you being arrogant because you knew your character would be arrogant?
I was playing the character. Yeah. it wasn't Forrest Whitaker being arrogant. I mean, I was like walking away from shots. You know, when you're playing the nine ball champion of the world and you're like hitting the ball and walking away and making sounds, that's extremely, you know, you know, like you're walking away, you're not looking at the shot, you're like, bow, and it hits the pocket. You know what I mean? That's, you know, it's a little much, but it was telling with the character. When I first got to Chicago, that's where I had to audition. It was like freezing. I remember I walked up to the hotel desk and I was like, excuse me, where's the pool hall? You know, and he's like, okay. And I was like, oh yeah. And I just went around the corner and started playing pool until, you know, so I was in that space, in that zone. Sometimes I can't really play pool at all now, but for some reason I have this savant way of like, while I'm doing something, I believe it. I believe that's what I'm doing. I believe it, and it starts to happen. You know, like I believe that I can do this thing. You know, and then sort of starts to happen.
Forrest Whitaker, mm-hmm. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Forrest Whitaker is starring in the new film, The Last King of Scotland. He begins his recurring role on ER this week. Coming up, we remember the singer Freddie Fender. He died of lung cancer Saturday. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The great Mexican-American singer Freddie Fender died of lung cancer on Saturday at the age of 69. He was born Baldomar Huerta in San Benito, Texas. As a child and teenager, they called him El Bebop Kid, and he made a name for himself playing on local radio stations. But his career really took off in the 50s, when he began doing Spanish-language versions of popular American songs like Elvis Presley's Don't Be Cruel. Fender became a star in 1975 with his hit Before the Next Teardrop Falls, which we'll hear in a moment. More recently, he played with the Tex-Mex bands The Texas Tornadoes and Los Super 7. He won Grammys with both. I spoke with Freddie Fender in 1990. Before we hear that conversation, let's listen to his first hit.
If he brings you happiness, then I wish you both the best. It's your happiness that matters most of all. But if he ever breaks your heart, if the teardrop ever starts, I'll be there before the next teardrop falls. Si te quiere de verdad y te da felicidad, te deseo lo más bueno para los dos. Pero si te hace llorar, a mí me puedes hablar y estaré contigo cuando triste estás.
Freddie Fender, you grew up near the Rio Grande, and you did migrant work as a child. How old were you when you had to start working?
Well, let's see. My father died January of 45. They did not even have the welfare program back then, and my mother was in very dire poverty. And the very first year, it was kind of rough because the war was still going on, and so that we suffered a lot from lack of food and shelter was not that good. About a year later, she found a man that she could get along with that she liked, and he took us all up north and to following the harvest, sort of the grapes of wrath thing, and that's how we made our living to the hell. In 1958, I was still I had records out and still picking onions in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
How did you start performing?
I started performing the radio stations. We had a little station called KGBS in Harlingen in San Benito, Texas, and we happened to know the DJ. This was 1946, 47. I was 9 or 10 years old, and I'd go over there with a guitar, and it was a big kick for him to see a little kid with a guitar singing.
I know that one of the records you made in the 1950s was a cover recording in Spanish of Elvis Presley's Don't Be Cruel. Whose idea was it to do that in Spanish? Was it your idea to do that?
In a way, I think that I gave the idea to the producer of the session that I did. I was Don't Be Cruel in Spanish and some other songs, the Elvis Presley hits, because at that time, we did not have Elvis Presley imitators. Everybody wanted to imitate Elvis Presley, whether you sang or not. And I had long sideburns. So the producer said, hey, let's do some Elvis Presley songs.
Was your image the Hispanic Elvis at the time?
Very much so. I was called a Bebop Kid and the Mexican Elvis Presley, believe it or not.
When did you change your name from Baldomar Huerta to Freddie Fender? Why did you change it?
Well, Wayne Duncan, who became my first manager, had a jukebox route. That's about as close as he was to the record business. And he said, I'm going to record you, and you're going to have to get a name where you can look at the jukebox, you'll put a nickel in it. And in other words, not Baldomar Huerta, you know? So I said, well, let me pick a name. So I picked Fender from the guitar and the amplifier, and Freddie just out of the air. Luckily, if you put a Y on Freddie instead of an IE, you will have the same amount of letters on it, which helps a lot when you print it on an album or something. You know, it comes out just right.
Let's go back to 1959 and your recording of Wasted Days and Wasted Nights. Now, you later recorded this in the mid-70s, and it was a big hit. But this is your first recording of it back in 1959.
Wasted days and wasted nights I have left for you behind. For you don't belong to me. Your heart belongs. Why should I keep loving you when I know that you're not true?
Freddie Fender recorded in 1959. Not too long after this record was made, you were busted at a club for what, holding three joints?
I wasn't holding anything, no.
Oh, okay. What was the story?
They found it in the apartment where I lived. They found some, maybe a couple of joints or something like that, and that was the end of that one, you know.
How long did you spend in prison for that?
2.5 years.
Is it right that you were paroled under the condition that you didn't get back into music?
Not really. I was paroled on the condition that I wouldn't be anywhere where they served liquor and anywhere they play music except for church. Even in church they serve wine, so I might as well, you know, just seal it up.
I see. So it wasn't that the judge, it wasn't so much that you weren't supposed to play music, it was that you weren't supposed to be around alcohol.
Yeah.
But what effect did that have on your music career?
I still went ahead and played and got away pretty good, you know.
Where'd you play, though, if you couldn't play at places that served alcohol?
Usually beer joints that didn't advertise.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I wouldn't play any public places. I'd just go to beer joints, little hell holes, you know. And nobody would know about it except the people that went there every day.
Well, that's not the best way to get discovered, is it?
No, I was young. I wasn't really thinking that much about discovery. As a matter of fact, my whole life, I have never expected anything, you know. I've just played music, that's all, you know. And if it happens, it happens. If it don't happen, well, hell, I'm still playing, you know. I was shooting for success and waiting for failure without being afraid of failure. Now I fear failure just tremendously. I've gone to the other side now, you know. If I fail, man, I'm going to be real hurt because I know what success is now, and I want it, you know.
Freddie Fender, he died Saturday of lung cancer. He was 69.
A man can cry. A love can surely die. They're not here to stay. The sunshine and the rain. Let me, oh, oh, let me tell you, baby, I'm still in love with you. Blue skies above, the tide mountain high is to prove my love. Of this love have I. But let me, oh, oh, let me tell you, baby, I'm still in love with you.
That's Freddie Fender, recorded in 1990 with the Texas Tornadoes, singing his song, A Man Can Cry. This is Fresh Air. We're grateful that we're often able to play back interviews from our archive to pay tribute to performers and writers who have died, like Freddie Fender. Listener support has kept us on the air and enabled us to create the Fresh Air Archive. Your station is fundraising today. Your support will not only help keep Fresh Air on the air, it will help keep your station on the air. So I hope you'll call now. Thank you.
The hit show Lost began its third season October 4th, in a year that has so far been dominated by the CSI franchise, with three shows in the top 10. Our critic at large, John Power, says the success of these crime procedurals isn't surprising. He thinks the difference between shows like Lost and CSI says a lot about current TV.
When I was a kid, my friends and I used to argue about who was better, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones. And though this was silly, heck, we loved them both, the opposition did point to a truth. For the Sunny Fab Four and the Satanic Stones did embody two very different attitudes toward music and life. And so we argued over who was greater, just as people once debated the merits of deadpan Buster Keaton versus sentimental Charlie Chaplin, or terse Ernest Hemingway versus windy William Faulkner. These days, the most telling opposition can be found on TV, where audiences have made mega-hits of two very different dramas, CSI and Lost. Where the CSI juggernaut is devoutly materialist, Lost deals in what we might call metaphysical pop. If you've seen the original CSI even once, you know how the whole franchise works. It's all about procedure. After a couple of apparently baffling murders, William Peterson and his crime scene investigators turn up to examine the physical evidence and interrogate suspects. By the end of every episode, you can count on the portentous Peterson to produce that telltale flake of DNA-rich dandruff that will send the cocky murderer straight up the river. Case closed, mystery solved, in Las Vegas, Miami, or New York. And CSI is hardly alone. The same procedural materialism lies at the heart of the Law & Order franchise and the medical hit House, where each week the most flabbergasting diseases wind up receiving a reassuringly scientific explanation and cure. The pleasure of such shows lies in their neatness, their rationality, their sense of order being restored. What was mysterious at the beginning will be neatly explained by the facts, just like on Jack Webb's old show Dragnet. This is almost the opposite of why people enjoy Lost, whose appeal is, well, trippy. Its fun comes in wading through a series of vast, ever-expanding mysteries. The show's plane crash survivors don't merely confront weird things on their island, like a strange hatch with its ticking clock. The island forces each character to work out a personal destiny foreshadowed in the show's many flashbacks. Far from solving a mystery every week, each new episode suggests the presence of cosmic forces so vast that beginning the third season, one is still struggling to understand the big picture. Something similar happens in the new hit show Heroes, which clearly follows in Lost's wake. It's about a collection of people with extraordinary powers who must discover their role in some grand scheme. If metaphysical pop is your thing, this show's opening words are sheer catnip.
Where does it come from? This quest, this need to solve life's mysteries when the simplest of questions can never be answered. Why are we here? What is the soul? Why do we dream? Perhaps we'd be better off not looking at all. Not delving, not yearning. That's not human nature. Not the human heart. That is not why we are here.
While the pleasure of CSI materialism lies in its rational order, the joy of shows like Lost and Heroes lies in the elusive sense that the meaning of things transcends workaday materialistic reason. This is an idea that's grown increasingly popular in recent years. It's there in Six Feet Under's ghostly visitations and sense of people working out ineffable destinies. It's there in new shows like Six Degrees and The Nine, which are all about uncovering hidden relationships. And it's there in the Oscar-winning Crash, whose meaning lay in the pattern of its stories, not the individual stories themselves. Which brings us to HBO's police drama The Wire. It's the best show on TV, precisely because it brings together what's enjoyable about CSI and Lost. Now, at one level, The Wire is the TV show most grounded in the material reality of daily life. It's procedure in all its humanity. We see what happens on Baltimore's street corners, in its schools and squad rooms and political campaigns. The characters do their jobs, but they also get drunk, take bribes, shirk their duty. You see, that's procedure too. But unlike CSI or Law & Order, The Wire's materialism does not lead to a satisfying sense of order or resolution. Far from it. Watching these cops, and drug dealers and politicians and kids. We see individuals caught up in a crazy social system that defines their behavior. It is so big and complex that nobody's really in charge. As it focuses on the material reality of what's happening in Baltimore, the show paradoxically leaves us with a sense of mystery, every bit as spookily confounding as anything you'll find on Lost. Week after week, The Wire suggests that nothing could be more difficult than to create life-affirming order in the modern city. In a very real sense, this show's badge-carrying heroes, however good their intentions, really are lost at the crime scene.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon. Walk the straight and narrow track. If you walk with Jesus, he's gonna save your soul. You gotta keep the devil way down in the hole. He's got the fire and the fury at his command. Well, you don't have to worry if you hold on to Jesus' hand. We'll all be safe from Satan when the thunder rolls. We just gotta keep the devil way down in the hole.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Kuo, who was deputy director of the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives in the Bush administration. In his new memoir, Tempting Faith, he writes about his disillusionment with the administration, which he thinks used compassion and religion for its own political ends. Join us for the next Fresh Air.